Bien, donc bonjour à toutes et à tous et bienvenue à ce séminaire international de l'UHESS. Aujourd'hui, nous avons le plaisir d'accueillir le professeur Xiaoxin Dong qui est ici à Paris depuis février, qui a donné une série de conférences dont ce séminaire en fait est la dernière. Le professeur Dong enseigne à l'université Fudan. Donc, il est professeur d'histoire au National Institute for Advanced Humanistic Studies. Et ses travaux ont porté beaucoup sur la transition entre les dynasties Ming et Qing, et notamment sur les sources donc, occidentales de cette transition importante dans l'histoire de la Chine. Donc, il a travaillé sur la chrétienté, les jésuites et les missions jésuites donc, à cette époque, mais il a travaillé aussi sur la médecine. Voilà, donc vous avez publié pas mal d'ouvrages et vous préparez donc, un ouvrage sur Antonio de Boubert, donc jésuite portugais en Chine. Donc, peut-être il en sera question aujourd'hui aussi. Nous avons le plaisir donc, d'avoir des spécialistes reconnus, comme Thomas, ici. Serge Amy, merci d'être venu, et puis Antoine Lormano qui nous fait le grand plaisir, l'honneur de réagir en direct à cette présentation pour lancer le débat, pour essayer de nous donner plus d'éléments à ceux qui sont peut-être moins familiers avec ces thématiques et donc enrichir la discussion. Donc sans plus tarder, je laisse la parole au professeur Dong. Alors, merci encore d'être ici parmi nous.
Thank you very much, Professor Cléo Carrasco, Professor Romano, and Professor Chen, and all other students and professors, friends. It's really my honor to be here to present my research and exchange my ideas with all of you. And I think it's a very, very rare opportunity for me, and okay, I will cherish it. And in the past 3 weeks, I have already given 3 talks, 3 lectures on and the Ming-Qing dynastic transition in European sources, the Jesuits and the Southern Ming dynasties, and the Jesuits and the Tatars. These 3 talks are very specialized, somehow boring, right? So this time, under Professor Romano's suggestion, I will talk something more general. The title today is Sino-European Relations in Early Modern Period. This is a very big topic. It's almost the whole area of my research. And this topic is more challenging because there are too many things that deserve to be mentioned. So I think it will be better that I use more or less 15 minutes to give this presentation, and then we keep some time for discussion. I take some questions. And any questions on this topic, because it's quite large, big topic. So any questions on this topic are welcome. Okay, China, where is China? China locates in Eastern Eurasia continent, which together with Korea and Japan used to be called Far East or Far Orient, while Europe locates in the westernmost of this vast land. Chinese civilization and European civilization are two important civilizations of humankind, which last until today. It is quite interesting that to some extent, the developments of both civilizations are parallel. I think many scholars found this phenomenon that the development of Europe and the development of China is somehow parallel. In the era of Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, the area of Professor Cleon's yours area, who were living in the city-states of ancient Greece, we have Confucius, Mencius, and Xunzius, who were living in the spring and autumn and the warring states period of China, Shunqiu Dynasty. The Roman Empire corresponds to the Qing Han Empire. When Christianity, a religion originated from Middle East, entered into Roman Empire in the first century, almost at the same time, it's very interesting. Buddhism, a religion originated from the South Asia, came to Eastern Han Empire of China. When the barbarians invaded the Roman Empire in 4th century and 5th centuries, different barbarian nations such as Xiongnu, Xianbei, Jiedi, and Qiang invaded China and established many regions in the north. By the way, some scholars assume that it was the Huns, the Xiongnu, that moved to the west after defeated by Han Empire, initiated the barbarians' invasion into the Roman Empire. If this were true, then it would be one of the typical cases showing the early interactions between the East and the West of Eurasia continent. When Europe entered into the medieval period, which lasted 1,000 years, with the Christianity dominating the Europe ideology, China, however, passed through its flourishing period of Tang and Song dynasties. Confucianism is always the main ideology in imperial China. Buddhism had strong influence in China, but some scholars think Neo-Confucianism, the Li Xue, Song Ming Li Xue, got influence from Zen Buddhism, but different from Europe, China has almost never been a theocratic state, 政教合一的国家, never. No religion, neither Buddhism nor Taoism, could change the authority of the secular state. Thus, the Renaissance and the Enlightenment, which happened in Europe, could not happen in China, because we didn't have the same religious background, or we needn't this kind of Renaissance or Enlightenment. China had been always a secular society already, and there had not been a religious authority to be against or from which to get back to the humanity. When Europe faced the Mongol invasion in the 13th century, China's Song Dynasty had the same crisis. While Europe survived it, China soon fell. The Mongolian Empire made the land route open between Europe and East Asia. And we do have some examples of great travelers in this period, such as Italian Franciscan John of Plano Carbini, Flemish Franciscan William of Rubruck, Venetian, this one everybody knows, merchant Marco Polo, Moroccan traveler Muhammad Ibn Battuta, and a Chinese traveler Wang Dayuan in Yuan Dynasty, who traveled around the old continent. Although some scholars say that the Mongol era is the early period of globalization, I think it is still in medieval ages, lacking of modernity. At least I think we can discuss what's modernity and if it's really the early period of globalization and what's globalization. Generally speaking, the exchanges and interactions between Europe and China before 16th century are indirect and land route based and have less influence to both sides. The Persians, Turks, Sudans, Sutur, Arabians, and other nations of Western Asia, Central Asia, and Northern Asia are the middlemen and bridges of Eurasian exchanges. But things changed when Italian navigator Cristoforo Columbus, supported by the Spanish crown, arrived in America in 1492, and the Portuguese navigator Vasco da Gama passed the Cape of Good Hope and arrived in Calicut, India in 1498. The new sea route to Orient symbolizes the direct encounter of East and West. Since then, more and more products and goods flow in a global networks. More and more Europeans go throughout the world, establishing colonies, doing business, preaching Christianity, spreading Western culture, science and technology, learning knowledge from other societies, collecting information of all the world, and the whole world becomes truly global. In 1510, Portuguese fleet led by General Afonso de Albuquerque conquered Goa. Goa at the time was a Muslim trade port on the western coast of India and established the Portuguese state of India there. Only 1 year later, Albuquerque captured Malacca. This is Goa, and this is Malacca, which used to be a tributary state of Ming Dynasty. So it's our control, it's our power of China's control. The prince of Malacca went to Beijing to pursue protection and help, but the Ming refused to send military fleet to help them. 3 years later, this is Malacca. 3 years later, a Portuguese fleet led by Ovalles, this is George Ovalles, arrived on Tumen Island. It's an island just on the mouth of the Pearl River, Canton Guangdong province. It was the first time that European ships appeared in China coast since the Roman ambassador sent by Emperor Marcus Antoninus in 166 in Eastern Han Dynasty. But that ambassador recorded in the Han Hou Han Shu, in the history of Hou Han, is a very, very isolated case. So we don't, just one sentence, we didn't have more evidence to support that an envoy came from Rome, visited Eastern Han Dynasty. In 1517, Tommy Pelles, a Portuguese pharmacist who had been in South and Southeast Asia for several years, and who was the author of the Summa Oriental Summary, Oriental Summary, was sent by the governor of the Portuguese state of India as ambassador to China, wishing to establish a normal trade relation with Ming Dynasty. Pelles' mission failed because the Ming court knew the Portuguese capture of Malacca, and the Portuguese seamen led by Simon the Advent rose conflicts on China coast at that time. The ambassador and his group were sent back to Guangzhou, where they were put into jail and died several years later. But somebody says that Pilas didn't die soon, but survived and lived until 54 days and married with a Chinese woman and had a child. Well, it's only one book recorded like this. Without the permission from the Ming government, the Portuguese did smuggling trade with Chinese and Japanese pirates along Guangdong, Fujian, and Zhejiang coast, but they were defeated several times by Ming maritime military in the first half of 16th century. So at that time, you know, China is strong enough to defeat the Portuguese. After 30 years of failure, they became smarter. They bribed the local maritime official, Hui Lu, and got the small peninsula of Macau as their settlement in 1557. Not like Goa and Malacca and many other Portuguese colonies in Asian seas, which were occupied by military forces, Macau was a settlement they rented from China, and each year they needed to pay a sum of money as rent. So that's why we don't say Macau is a colony, a Portuguese colony. In 1549, Portuguese arrived at Tanegashima Island, and from then on, they continued to trade with Japan for almost a century. Portuguese merchants, as well as the Catholic missionaries who came along with them, were welcomed by some local feudal lords, Dami, and of Japan, because they could purchase Chinese goods and European firearms from them. In 1571, the Portuguese made their first visit to Nagasaki. Almost at the same time, Portuguese merchants in Macau got permission to go to Canton, Guangzhou, for the semi-annual trade fairs. I think most of the Chinese students know the trade fair in Guangzhou is still there now. So it began at least 4 centuries ago. From then on, Nagasaki was recognized as the terminal port of the annual port of the so-called Great Portuguese Sea from Macau. 9 years later, Nagasaki was offered to the Jesuits by the Christian Damil Omula Sumitada, on the condition that they would make their only port of destination in Japan. In 1587, Toyotomi Hideyoshi, Feng Chen Xiuji, pacified Kyushu and promulgated a ban on Christianity. Then he took Nagasaki over and turned it into a municipality under the direct control of his government. But he let the profitable Macau-Nagasaki trade continue. Sino-Japanese relations completely broke down in the 1590s because of the two consecutive invasions by Toyotomi Hideyoshi's army into Korea. And Japan placed itself off the traditional tribute trade system in East Asia. The interruption of the official trade between China and Japan resonated deeply in the international sphere. The lifestyle of Japanese in this period developed a strong desire for Chinese commodities such as silk and porcelain, while Japanese silver was much in demand in China, owing partly to the elimination of paper currency in Ming China, a serious wrong policy move, as we know now. But maybe it's not wrong, but I think maybe the paper currency is cheaper. The Japanese historian Tashiro Kazuyu Kendai thinks that the Europeans choose an extremely inopportune time to put in their first appearance, because from the middle of the 16th century, conditions in Japan and the rest of the Northeast Asia grew increasingly chaotic. But I think that on the contrary, this was the best opportunity for the Europeans to step in this area. For both China and Japan need a middleman to maintain the Sino-Japanese trade. The Portuguese soon replaced the Chinese and Japanese pirates to play the role of a steady and reliable link in the East Asia trade networks. The Portuguese role switching was benefited by the policy adjustments of both China and Japan while facing the changing circumstances in East Asia. The traditional tribute system could not meet the needs of international trade, and this was proved not only by the termination of the Chinese-Japanese tribute relations, but even more by the more and more serious problems of the pirates and the smugglers. The most important policy adjustment made by China government was allowing the Portuguese merchants from a non-tributary country to live and trade on a small plot of Chinese soil. Under the control and administration of Chinese local officials, this policy generated a new trade system different from the traditional one, which could be called the Canton Macau system. This new system, coexisting with the old one, became more stable after the appearance of the commercial links between Macau and Nagasaki. And accordingly, the problem of pirates was partly resolved. So if you do business, there's no pirates. If you forbid to do business, there are pirates. When Dutch moved to the offensive in their 80 years war of independence against Spain at the end of 16th century, it was on the Portuguese rather than on the Spanish colonial possessions that their harvest and most persistent attacks were concentrated. The Dutch systematically seized the Portuguese inner port trade of Asia from the Persian Gulf to Japan. And they reduced many of the long chain of Portuguese coastal settlements by picking them off one by one. So the Dutch is a new power uprising. In the first decade of the 17th century, the Dutch launched a series of attacks on the Portuguese fortresses and trading posts from Malacca to Japan, as well as a series of capture actions to the Portuguese ships in this maritime space. In 1603, the Portuguese Carac. Carac is a kind of a very big ship. Santa Catalina, which was destined to Malacca, was captured by the Dutch ships. And in order to keep the rich cargoes, there are lots of porcelains on this ship. The newly organized Dutch East Indian Company called upon Hugo Grotius to draft a polemical defense of the seizure. So I think for the Western scholars, it's very, very familiar with Hugo Grotius, but for the Chinese student, maybe not. In Chinese, Hugo Grotius is a famous ocean founder. In 1609, Grotius Marie Liberon de Frisi was published, in which he formulated the new principle that the sea was international territory and all nations were free to use it for seafaring trade. By claiming free seas, Grotius provided a suitable ideological justification for the Dutch breaking up of the Iberian trade monopolies and then establishing their own. In the same year, the Dutch gained a foothold at Hirado in Japan, the Pinghu. Then they gained a red seal certificate from Tokugawa Ieyasu, which permitted them the privilege of free trade. The second decade saw the ceasefire between the Dutch and the Iberian colonial empire, which is called the 12 Years' Truce. It was during this ceasefire the Dutch made great efforts to strengthen their position in Asia, which was later to have a crucial bearing on the course of the war. New attacks were immediately launched by the Dutch when the truce ended. They launched a powerful blow on Macau in June 1622, but it was repulsed with heavy losses on the Dutch side. It's almost the first time that the Dutch lost a war with Portuguese ships. Macau was the only place on China coast where the Dutch failed in their efforts to expel the Portuguese. After this failure, the Dutch fleet sailed to the Pescadores, Penghu Leda, and proceeded to set up a base there. However, the Ming authorities warned the Dutch that the Pescadores were Chinese territory and suggested that they instead move to Taiwan and establish themselves there. So that's a proof or evidence that at least in Ming Dynasty, Taiwan was not part of China. Because the officials suggested the Dutch to move to Taiwan. In 1623, Dutch traders in search of an Asian base first arrived on Formosa, that's Taiwan, and in the following year, they finally occupied Taiyuan, now Tainan, and erected a castle there. Taiwan is close to Chinese mainland, and Taiyuan was duly made to be a distributing center of Chinese silk, Japanese silver, as well as other Far Eastern goods. The third Tokugawa Shogun, Iemitsu, enacted a number of edicts and policies in 1630s, which was called Sakaku, Sakoku. In Chinese, 锁国政策 policies, later in but it's a word used appeared only in 1801. But Sakoku, the closed country, is not altogether accurate because there were still four countries, China, Korea, and Liukyu, and the Dutch, that could go to trade in or nearby Nagasaki. In fact, as the trade with the English and Spanish had been already ceased during 1623 to 24, this series of seclusion policies was only directed against one foreign country, Portugal. Thus, Japan replaced the Portuguese with the Dutch to trade, whereas China still kept relations with the Portuguese without permitting the Dutch to come. So it's very interesting. You can see the difference between China and Japan facing the European powers. The loss of the Nagasaki trade was a critical blow for the Portuguese of Macau, and for a time they even wanted to abandon this settlement founded 80 years ago. At that time, the Portuguese there in Macau, its situation very hard. The golden period of Macau passed away mainly due to the competition of the Dutch. The reasons of the success of the Dutch have been deeply discussed by former scholars. The Dutch had two principal advantages. First, the organization of VOC was more suitable for their overseas expansion. The VOC was a semi-state organization, which had not only the rights of monopoly, the trade in the entire Indian and Pacific Ocean, but also the rights of conscription, legislation, appointment and remove of officials, declaration of war, and the conclusion of peace, as well as monetization. Secondly, VOC had deliberately avoided the connections with the Roman Catholic Church, and Dutch overseas expansion was not under the cloak of religion. Hence, they did not have missionary burden. Most of the Japanese authorities didn't like Christianity, which I will talk later. And both Hideyoshi and Ieyasu had chafed under the necessity of tolerating Christian missionaries in the land, owing to their wish not to antagonize or destroy the valuable Portuguese commerce. So it may easily be imagined with what delight Ieyasu welcomed the advent of the Hollanders in Japan, and he was not slow to perceive that there was a stout stick, 很坚强的棍子打, wherewith to beat the Portuguese. Although China also banned Christianity in 1616, it continued to trade with the Portuguese because when the Ming government faced growing pressure at northeast frontier, which I talked in the past three presentations, the Portuguese and the Jesuits of Macau took the opportunity to provide military assistance. Thereby, the status of Macau was consolidated and the Jesuits maintained their existence in China. The Portuguese and Jesuits in China accused the Dutch that the latter were nothing than pirates. That's true. And partly because of their accusations, the Chinese refused the Dutch to establish any trading business in China. The appearance of the Dutch in East Asia and their replies of the Portuguese in the Sino-Japanese trade impacted on the traditional trade system even more. Although it did not exceed the Canton-Macau system, which was a traditional pattern between the tribute trade system and the Kohan system, 就在朝贡贸易与工行制度之间的一种制度。It is not a good signal when two strangers fight just outside your door, right? And what you should do is to prevent the fire touching your house. That's why entire China, either China or Japan, choose only one European country to trade with and strictly limited them in a small area. And this cautious policy could be understood especially in the early period of the contacts between East and West. Anyway, it is extremely wrong regarding China and Japan as closed countries. They never been closed. The Dutch-Portuguese conflict in East Asia was part of the competition between new and old colonial powers in the whole world. Japan chose capitalism, least Holland, while China maintained its relations with the feudal monarchy of Portugal. But it will be equally wrong if through this difference one tries to explain the different path that Japan and China choose, because neither Japan nor China knew the difference of the political system between Portugal and Holland in the 1630s. The Portuguese in Macau continued their relations with China after the Ming-Qing dynastic transition, whereas the Dutch still hadn't a chance. And although they tried again by sending a large diplomatic mission to Qing court in early Kangxi period, but they also failed. They got only 8 years. In 8 years, that they got the permission to come once to China to contribute or doing contributory business. But in 1684, 1 year after the Qing defeated the Zheng's regime and got the whole control of Taiwan, the Qing government opened four ports, Guangzhou, Fuzhou, Ningbo, and Songjiang. And so at that time, there are four ports allowing foreign merchants coming for trade. But in 1757, Qing closed the other three ports and Guangzhou became the only one port for foreign trade, Yikou Tongshang. Ships from Holland, England, United States, France, Sweden, Denmark, Austria, etc., came to Guangzhou. I think I can, this picture, yes. You can see lots of flags, the foreign factories in Guangzhou. And Guangzhou was one of the biggest trade ports in the world in the second half of 18th century. China was an important chain of the world trade networks in early modern period. Tea, porcelain, silk, lacquers, along with many other Chinese products, were transported to the entire world. At the same time, large amount of silver flew into China from America and Japan. The flow direction changed in late 18th century and the first half of 19th century, mainly due to the opium trade to China. So at that time, the flow of silver is going out. Another aspect of Sino-European economic relations I would like to supplement is overseas Chinese. I have several overseas Chinese. When the Portuguese established their settlements in Malacca and other islands in Southeast Asia, the Dutch occupied Taiwan and later in Batavia in 17th century, and the Spanish captured and controlled Manila. Many Chinese merchants and laborers, or later coolies, mainly from Fujian and Guangdong, went there doing business and earning a living. The Europeans needed them in business. They appointed some Chinese elites to manage the Chinese communities that normally located outside of the city. The Chinese community called in Manila called Parian. Chinese are good laborers and good at doing business. Am I right? Think so. The colonial governments often had conflicts with them when they got rich. So, massacres, 屠杀, happened several times in Batavia, Manila, and some other places. For example, the Spanish colonists massacred 20,000 Chinese in Manila in 1603. The Dutch colonists killed more than 10,000 Chinese in Batavia in 1740. The central government of China received this information, but neither Ming nor Qing wanted to do anything to save the lives of overseas Chinese, because they thought these people were not Chinese anymore when they left China. So it's a very old, very traditional Chinese idea. So now I have to switch to the missionary issue. That's the second part of my presentation today. The Society of Jesus, founded in 1534 in Paris. I think lots of students have already visited the Montmartre, where Spanish veteran Ignacio de Loyola was admitted by the Pope, founded the society, and this society was admitted by the Pope in 1540, and soon got supported by, from the Portuguese king. Its main goal is to spread Catholicism to the whole world when the Roman Church was facing the challenge of the Protestant. One of the founders, Spanish Jesuit Francisco Xavier, was sent by the society and the Portuguese king to Oriental India in 1542. After preaching Christianity in India for several years, Xavier went to Japan with the wish of converting the Japanese kingdom. The Japanese told him that if the Chinese were converted into Christianity, it would be much easier for the Japanese to be converted, because the Japanese always regarded Chinese as their teacher. So Xavier left Japan for China. In 1552, he arrived at the island of Shangchuan on the coast of Guangdong, waiting for an opportunity to enter into mainland China. Unfortunately, he got ill and died on the island in December. So we still can see a church on the island and a tomb, but it's not his body was already transported to Goa. Since then, the Jesuits, as well as the Franciscans and the Dominicans, had tried many times to get into China, but they all failed. At the beginning of 1580s, Jesuit visitors of China and Japan made new strategies for China mission. He asked the newly arrived Jesuits in Macau to learn Chinese and study Chinese culture before they went into China. Italian Jesuits Ruggieri and Ricci established successfully the first Jesuit residence in Zhaoqing, Guangdong province, in 1582. Due to their capacity of speaking Chinese that they learned in Macau. So it's very difficult for the Europeans to learn Chinese. So at the beginning, these Jesuits hired some painters to draw pictures so to learn Chinese. Ruggieri and Ricci started a new era of Sino-European cultural exchanges. Since then, there were more and more European missionaries coming to China. From 16th to 18th centuries, a period of 200 years, there are about 1,000 European Catholic missionaries who came to China. 1,000. More than 1,000. Most of them are Jesuits, and there are also Franciscans, Dominicans, Augustines, Lazaristas, and missionaries of the foreign mission of Paris. They come from almost every nation of European continent, even from Czech, Czech, and Poland. But about one third of them are Portuguese Jesuits. Mario Ricci, Adam Shaw Van Bell, Julio Alani, Francisco Sabiensi, Ferdinand Verbist, Giuseppe Castiglioni, and French Jesuit Jacques Bilou, Claude de Vistello, Dominique Pahani, and Gauville are some of the most famous and important ones. Most of these missionaries lived in China for a long period, in some cases more than half century, and died in China. We have missionary cemeteries in Beijing, Hangzhou, Fuzhou, Shanxi, Hainan Island, and other places. I put the wrong place of the slides. This is a dictionary that edited by Ricci and Ruggieri, and used by them. And Ruggieri and Ricci arrived in Guangzhou, and even Ruggieri wrote some Chinese poems, like Chinese elementary school students wrote some poems. And most of them are good at Chinese language, and some of them, especially the French Jesuits, also can speak, read, and write in Manchu. They wrote about 1,000 books in Chinese. This is also a very a big number, anyway. And some Manchu books. Some of these books are on science and technology, so others are catechism and theological books. Theological books. If we look at the quantity of the Chinese Christians, they converted in this period, it seems that they are not quite successful. In late Ming, the number of Chinese Christians never reached to 10,000. The top number appeared in middle 18th century, which is about 200,000. But compared with the whole population of China, which is about 200 million at in the middle of the 18th century, the Chinese Christians are still a tiny group. This is more clear when we compare this number with that in Japan. In early 17th century, it is said that there are about 1 million Japanese Christians. Chinese government of Ming and Qing, as well as Japanese government of Tokugawa Shogunate, don't like Christianity because it is an exclusive religion and a potential threat to the secular authorities. Chinese people don't like Christianity either because they have a very practical attitude on faith. There is no problem when they pray to Christian God and at the same time pray to Buddha. Besides, many Chinese people can't endure the Christian commandments. For example, concubine is always one of the main obstacles the Chinese laity have to face when they think about their conversion. Confucianism, I think, requests them to have more wives if they had no son with his first wife. But compared with Tokugawa Japan, Ming and Qing China is more tolerant to Christianity. There are two persecutions. One happened in 1616, the other happened 50 years later, which only several Chinese Christians were executed, and no foreign missionaries were killed. In Japan, after the ban of Christianity, tens of thousands of Japanese Christians and many foreign missionaries were killed or tormented in many terrible ways. I think I show some pictures here. For example, this kind of punishment. You can see these cases in the movie entitled Silence, right? Silence, which came this year. Although the number of Chinese Christians is small, in 18th century, the Qing government issued strict ban of preaching Christianity. This European religion survived and rooted in China. Some Christian communities of this period in Zhejiang, Fujian, Shanxi, and Hubei have kept their Christian faith until nowadays. So you still have can visit some, you can see some Christian village continued since the Ming Qing dynasties. To this extent, we can also say that the Catholic mission in early modern period in China is quite successful. If we regard the missionary activities in China as Sino-European cultural exchanges, then their work in China can be more successful. They introduce European culture, science, and technology into China, and introduce Chinese culture and civilizations into Europe, which have deep influences and impacts on both sides. The Jesuits introduced European geography, mathematics, geometry, canons, medicines, mechanics, arts, music, and many other aspects into China. The world map drawn by Richie Sambiasi, the world maps, not one map, many maps, and were best showed to the Chinese people for the first time the whole world and changed Chinese traditional idea of under heaven, 天下. The Jesuits reformed the Chinese calendar in 17th century, and the new calendar is still used in China now. We call it the lunar calendar, we still use it now. But it's reformed and rewritten by the Jesuits. In early Qing until the whole 18th century, the directors of the calendar bureau were always European missionaries. Chinese people hadn't had a geometrical way of thinking, 几何思维, geometrical way of thinking. And they began to have it since Matthew Ricci's translation of Euclidean geometry. The Jesuits introduced the canons into Ming Dynasty to help China to resist the Manchu invasion. But ironically, the Manchus captured many canons and learned how to use them to conquer China. Adam Shaw and Webist continued to make canons for the Qing, which played a key role in fighting against the rebellions and in the conquests of Xinjiang. There were a group of missionary doctors working in Kangxi's court, and Emperor Kangxi personally received surgery by the French Jesuit. I think I can show you some. This is a cemetery. The professors knew it very well. A telescope was also introduced into China and the observatory in Beijing. The canons. It's something about the calendar reform and something for the medicine. The Jesuits also translated European anatomical books into Chinese and Manchu, which showed a different way of understanding human body. We have our own ideas to understand our body, but it's different from the way of Europeans. You can see some of them. There were also a group of missionary artists working in Qianlong's court, because Qianlong is so interested in art, and introducing European oil painting and perspective and shadow technique into China, a technique of painting into China. This group invented an art style mixed Chinese and European painting. They also designed the royal garden. Oh, it's on some paintings, huh? The royal garden, Yuan Ming Yuan, which was destroyed by the British and French army in 1860, which is also very ironic. The Jesuits in China were pursuing a policy called accommodation. They were learning Chinese language and culture, wearing Chinese costumes, partly adapting Chinese customs, and always trying to make friends with Chinese officials and literati. They permitted Chinese Christians keeping their custom of worshipping their ancestors and Confucius. which the Franciscans and Dominicans thought unacceptable. They argued and quarreled with the Jesuits for a long time. They presented this case to County Admiral, who issued an edict of tolerance in 1692, but now got bored by these quarrels and declared a ban of preaching Christianity in China in his last year of life. When French missionaries of the foreign mission of Paris, Charles the bishop of Fujian presented himself in the court trying to explain this issue to Emperor Kangxi. Kangxi Emperor laughed at him, saying that you even cannot speak Chinese. How dare you comment on our customs? The controversy of Chinese rites also extended to the Vatican, where both sides needed to present their evidences to support their standpoint. To do so, both sides studied deeply the Chinese classics, which accidentally promoted the missionary sinology at that time. The Jesuits had written several chronicles of Chinese history, and now they translated the whole four books, the Great Learning, Da Xuan, the Doctrine of the Ming, Zhong Yong, the Analects of the Confucius, Lun Yu, and Mencius, into Latin. They also translated the Book of Changes, Yi Jing, and other Chinese classics into European languages and published in Europe in late 17th century and 18th century. Chinese knowledge and culture had influence in Europe in a different way. Famous European scholars like Leibniz and Kircher, for example, got influence from Chinese culture and had publications on China based on the information from Jesuits. But what is the most important is that some aspect of the Chinese culture became weapons used by the enlightened thinkers to attack the church. A typical case is that they found the history of China was longer and older than the records in the Bible. Hence, they doubted the Roman Church through doubting the Bible. Talking about the influence of Chinese culture in Europe in 17th and 18th centuries, we have to mention the Shinowazaki, right? Shinowazaki, which I think lots of students may be interested in or are studying this area. Shinowazaki, the interpretation and imitation of Chinese artistic traditions in decorative arts, garden design, architecture, and other areas. We can still see art pieces of this style in Europe today, which you must know better than me, I think, because these days I traveled in Paris a little bit, and so it's very normal to find a piece of this style. Another aspect of Chinese influence, which has not been discussed deeply, I think, is modern science. I showed some other picture. You have lots of this kind of pictures on the internet. The Jesuits, especially the French Jesuits in China, wrote many scientific reports to the academies of science in Paris, London, and St. Petersburg. Sending scientific data, natural species, and other materials and information they collected in China for the reference of the European scientists. Many of these judges were also correspondent members of these academies. So if I say China got involved in the process of the development of modern science and technology in a special way, it would not be too wrong. I think that's my presentation. Thank you. And I hope you have some questions for the discussion. Thank you.